following Q&A session was recorded on August 23rd, 2025, at the Bullet Lake Baptist Church Men's Ministry Family Day event. Homesteading expert John Moody takes questions from the audience about homesteading, gardening, and the productive household.
Until very recently, was rooted in houses. What is the word we use to describe productivity at a national scale? It's a college and high school subject. Anybody? Huh? Well, that's a word, but GDP is part of a broader topic.
Economics.
Does anyone know what two words economics comes from? Economy, but what are the two words? It's oikos, which is the Greek word for household, and nomos, which is the Greek word for rule or dispensement. So Paul uses the Greek word okeonomos, man, maybe nine different times in the New Testament. It's a word, so the original Xenophon, back in probably 600 BC, he wrote a book called the Oikionomos, which was a book that redefined the ancient world, Greek and Latin. A lot of his book echoes in Paul's household letters. And you can get it in English. It's only probably 20 pages in English. Really fun, worthwhile read. So economics, original meaning was a productive household. The right dispensement and management of the resources of a household, which include the people of the household. So I really like thinking about this as a Christian from this perspective of, you know, there are three great institutions God created that are the fundamental glue of the world. There's, and the most foundational of those institutions is the household. And then you also have the church, and then you have the state. But economics originally, productivity, all of this was originally rooted in and tied to our homes. And modern homes have become little more than places people go. I always like to call them castles of consumption. Most people work outside the home to finance everything that happens inside the home. Almost everything in the home is consumptive in orientation and nature. And so homesteading is one manifestation of how to have a more productive, biblically oriented home. But it's not the only one. So just by way of like little, you know, prolegia, getting intro stuff out of the way. But we've had basically a productive household homestead since 2009. You were born, you should remember, you're like four. I never wanted to live in a big city. I'm heavily influenced by Francis Schaeffer, who said in one of his books, just people aren't made to grow up surrounded by concrete and steel and cut off from the sky. And so back when things were a little bit more affordable, we bought land and a house outside of Louisville. I really like Michael Foster's point about these things, that some people in their desire to build a productive house cut themselves off from civilization. I have friends who've moved to incredibly rural areas, which really excites the mom and dad, and then all of their children have to move away because there's things like no spouses and no jobs and other stuff. So, but I think we're ready for...
Yeah. Did y'all get your names in? Thank y'all. Sorry.
Great to meet you.
I meant for the book giveaway, sorry.
Just in case anybody was wondering or had forgot. I've been parts of churches for years, and I'm always like, I don't remember that dude's name. You know, you've been there where you like are always edging over when you know they're going to introduce them to someone new because you're like, I should know that person's name.
Yeah.
But I don't.
Okay. So, yeah, to be an open Q&A, and It's going to be recorded, so I'll just pass the mic around if whoever wants to go first.
Heather, would you like to go first?
Sarah, I know you.
I can also just tell you, you know, if you all need a moment to think of questions, how many of you watched Sesame Street growing up? Not 5,000. So this is one of my favorite stories. Okay. So those of you who watch Sesame Street, who teaches you your numbers on Sesame Street? The Count. What is the Count? He's a vampire. He is a blood-sucking creature of darkness and despair. So you have big fluffy birds, other cute plushy animals, and then you have a demon creature that teaches your small children numerals. Did you ever ask yourself why? Why Sesame Street chose a vampire to be who teaches math? And it has something to do with elderberries. Yes, it does. So imagine you live in far Eastern Europe in the Middle Ages. And a village over, what's the next town over from Bullet? You know, is it like Shepherdsville or...
we're here in Shepherdsville, and then Mount Washington, the next town over.
You know, so Mount Washington, there's a vampire sighting. How are you going to protect your family?
Garlic.
So you think bad breath is going to stop a creature of darkness and despair? It works in the movie. So garlic.
That's what the movies say.
Yeah. I don't know if I trust the movies. How are you going to stop a vampire? Coming for your family. So you're going to do hand... Now, if I was his size, I might consider doing hand-to-hand combat with an immortal creature with super strength and trying to shove a little piece of splinter through his heart so that my family does not die. But that's a little bit above my pay grade. How are you going to stop a vampire? But how would you use the elderberry? So they would put clusters of elderberries on the windowsills of their houses. But why? Why would that stop a vampire? What is one of the earliest attested weaknesses of vampires in ancient European literature? Well, sunlight. But he's coming at night, you know. Not stake through the heart, not bad breath. You're a peasant, silver's too expensive, and the church is far away, and they charge a lot for holy water back then. So it is obsessive compulsive counting disorder. Vampires don't have to want to count. Vampires don't need to count. They have no choice but to count objects. So you'd set the elderberries on your windowsill, and the vampire would go to climb up through your house, and he'd have to start counting the elderberries. And how many of you have ever had a cluster of elderberries? They're uncountable. You can look at the picture on the front of my one book. And he'd start to count the elderberries, and he'd lose track, and he'd start over. He'd start again, lose track, start over. The sun would rise. He would run home. You'd be the hero of the village by stopping the vampire. So I told this story at a conference years ago, and a guy comes up to me after I tell the story. He goes, "You are the best confidence man I have ever seen. You can make up stories and tell them that anyone..." Like, he really thought I just made it up. So I see the guy 4 years later, walks up to me after another conference, pulls out his phone. He goes, "You got to see this clip." So he pulls it up. It's a clip from the TV show X-Files. I never watched X-Files. And the one character is trapped in a hotel room with a vampire. And there's a little coffee table between him and the vampire. And they're playing that children's game where, like, one goes this way, the other, you know, like which direction could go around the table, chasing each other. And the guy's like, "I'm going to die to a vampire." And he looks down on the table, and there's little packets of salt and sugar. So he grabs a packet of salt or sugar, rips it open, throwing the crystals across the floor. And the vampire goes to jump and sees the salt and sugar and goes, "One, two, three, four," and starts counting. And he gets away. He's like, "You weren't lying." Finally, believe me, because of a TV show. So what questions do you have homesteading, productive, household-wise? Because you all came for a Q&A, but you so far have no cue. It's like you're a game of Scrabble that one of my children got into.
What did you say?
So we started when we were in Louisville. Yeah.
Sorry. So, what did you start with when you started homesteading? What kind of kind of endeavor?
So I was getting my master's degree in Louisville. I married my wife in 2005. We lived in a small apartment building, but it had a basement. And the very first thing I started doing was gorilla worm composting in the basement of the apartment building. My neighbors thought, you know, we started doing everything at home, including having our children there.
But
no, it's been way less than 2 decades. Yeah, my children do think I'm a much more mellow person now. I mean, 6 years, you know, six kids in 20 years kind of does that to you. You know, so we were living in an apartment building, and we began doing things like composting. I did some raised bed gardening. It is amazing how much you can do with what you already have. This is something I heard Joel Salatin say probably 20-some years ago now. But he said, if you think getting 5 acres or 10 acres or this or that will mean you will finally do the things you've dreamed of, you're lying to yourself. Do them now with whatever you have. Oh, all you have is an apartment with a balcony? Then why don't you have herbs and plants growing on the balcony? All you have is a windowsill? Nothing is stopping you right now but yourself. And the reason you're not doing more is because you don't actually want to. Generally not because you can't. So I was like, I'm going to max out what we can do right where we are. And so we did some raised planter boxes of some different vegetables. And we did worm composting in the basement. And we had babies on the couch. And it was just like a grand old time for everybody. And our neighbors thought we were totally crazy people.
Vine borers on squash plants.
Oh, gosh. So there is, you know, it's, what does Treebeard say when he sees Fangorn Forest cut down? There's like no curse in Elvish or Entish or any other language of men for this, you know, this treachery. Man, squash bugs and vine borers are some of the most evil creatures in the world. So, guy by the name of Mee Gardener, Michigan Gardener, he has a squash vine borer repellent recipe, which you have to apply, you know, once or twice a week during the growing season, but it's fairly effective. The other thing with both squash bugs and squash vine borers is, especially if you can get a couple other gardeners close by you to buy into this, it's a battle of attrition. And so if you will overplant your squash, and as soon as you see one that is attacked by a vine borer or infested by squash bugs, you grab it, you grab a flamethrower, tannerite, dynamite, whatever it is, or you just burn all the bugs. And you do that aggressively for a couple years, you will radically reduce the background population because you're breaking the life cycle. So if you can get a few people in a close area all committed to doing that, you can win a war of attrition and really cut down on the pressure of that pest. But Mee Gardener's recipe, good, solid, you know, it's basically essential oils and a few other ingredients.
Okay. I read where, in reference to those, can you delay planting your squash and?
Not with squash bugs and squash vine borer. Now, a lot of other things you grow, if you seed start indoors, or if you do other season extension or delay techniques, you can avoid height of pest pressure. You know, so I like to plant my potatoes on years that don't involve like 60 inches of rain in the first 4 months of the year. I'll plant potatoes in March so that I'm harvesting in June. You can also do fall potatoes in our region. It's actually much easier. I usually get better potatoes in the fall. For your broccoli and some, you know, for all of your crucifers, everything in that family that does not need pollination, you can also do simple exclusion through floating row cover. So there's a lot of techniques for managing pests without resorting to dangerous chemicals and without turning your children into endless slave labor where all they do is sit out in the garden picking, you know, like, you know, you offer them a penny and now with inflation, I got to pay them at least a dime. It gets really steep, you know, for them to pick bugs off. Yeah, I used to have a real hatred of squash vine borers. You know, but I really like, I think his name is, oh, his last name is Doherty. No, that's Sean and Beth. No, this guy's in Australia. So he's a different Doherty, but Sean and Beth are great. But he had a great line where he said, we need to stop growing things that want to die and stop killing things that want to live in terms of our base relationship to creation. And I'm like, I don't think the dude's a Christian at all. And I'm just like, this is much better than how I hear most Christians view relating to the natural world. I thought it was a really insightful way. So some things that I have just really hard time because of pests and disease pressure, I don't grow anymore. So I grow a lot of sweet potatoes because we have no pests and they just really want to grow well. So another thing you can do in your gardening is focus on things that actually want to live instead of things that feel like they're extra children because you have to baby them all summer long.
Now, I actually had a question on corn. So we've planted two blocks of corn in our garden, and the outside seems to pollinate and form ears very well, but the inside of the block, so you're talking about a 50-foot long 8-row to 6-row, but the entire inside struggles to even produce an ear. Very little silks. So twice in 2 years, double planting both years, staggering where they are in the garden. I don't know if it's an extra water thing, too much water this spring, or what it might cause it to just not form an ear.
I just say that if you've had this problem repeatedly, why aren't you breaking up the blocks and maybe doing rows of wildflower, you know, instead of doing one big 50-foot block? So there is a great study out of England or somewhere a number of years ago that showed, I think it was just 10%, by planting just 10% of row crop fields to wildflowers, it reduced the need for pesticide applications 80%. And it improved yields because of better pollination. So nature is not a monocrop. One thing I love about the book of Proverbs is the book of Proverbs constantly, Solomon is looking at things in nature. You know, look at the ant, consider this animal, look at how this works. When you look at nature, monoculture is not something you most ever see in nature. And so monocultures by design create nutrient imbalances in your soil. They create absolutely pest-happy areas. And they create hotbeds of disease that affect plants. So I just say, you know, maybe rethink your approach to how you're structuring your garden, especially the corn plot, and you might solve this problem pretty easily.
So I think, at least when I think of homesteading without any real knowledge or what's like portrayed on the media, it's like you have a farm with cows, chickens, the whole thing, everything's being produced for your family. Like, could you provide some perspective just from where you started, but like, what can homesteading look like when it's not all of that too? Like, what other things are still homesteading? Like you said, just having a productive household.
Yeah. So there's a million things you can do at home. So my wife makes our own soap. We make a lot of our own non-alcoholic fermented beverages. We make our own yogurt. These are all traditionally productive household type things that don't involve having an animal. And obviously, if you have a cow, And then you make your own yogurt. You know, there's this idea of going up and down, vertically integrating is how they describe it in business. You can vertically integrate as a productive household if you want. But that requires you wanting to have a cow, which requires you to be home at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. every single day for 9 months of the year. And so if we lived right next door to really good neighbors, we would probably have a dairy cow. We've raised beef cows in the past. I really miss having beef cattle. But it was fencing and sinkholes versus beef cattle, and the sinkholes and lack of fencing won. So there's so many different things. You know, medical skills were traditionally a part of a productive household. So herbalism and similar skills on the wife's side. And then on the guy's side, the ability to do basic triage when people are injured was just a very basic life skill for most of human history, because outside of the big cities, if you got hurt in rural areas, the doctor was a long way away. So every man in every household had some good basic medical training for what to do when somebody gets a laceration, somebody gets a bad puncture wound, somebody's cow horns you. You know, there's just all of these things in life that we used to be responsible for in the context of our broader communities and households, instead of relying on 100 different service providers who didn't exist back then to do that stuff for you. So I've done a fair bit of medical training over the years. One time, one of the kids sliced themselves. Super. I really do want to learn how to do stitching, as does Abby. We've gotten very good at taking animals apart, and I'm now like, we need to practice stitching things back together. But one of my kids cut themselves full. You know, we were weeding using machetes, and they hit themselves in their own shin. And so it's bleeding really, really bad. And I clean it. I completely close it up. But I hadn't had a chance to take a suturing stitching class yet, which is on my bucket list. And I get him to the local emergency room, not emergency room, emergent care. There's a little urgent care. And the doctor opens it up, and he's like, "This looks great." He's like, "Who? Like, did you ever see a doctor?" And that's the kind of men we want to be. We really want to be able to handle a lot of this stuff without having to lose an entire day of work to every small injury that our children assail themselves with. Amish communities are really good about this. They usually have somebody in every Amish community who's well-trained in handling burns and those types of issues, somebody who's trained in handling lacerations and wounds. So there's just so many things that you can do in-house. Trying to think what's, you know, value adding is one of the best places for young families. You can make your own toothpaste. You can make your own deodorant. I don't recommend making your own toilet paper. We didn't try that one, but I've seen some pretty crazy stuff. you can make your own compost for your garden, which I've never understood why people don't, because you create all of this organic matter waste from your garden. And then you pay somebody to haul it off for you. I was just like, why doesn't it just go back?
So I listen or read The Healthy Home Economist. I know she speaks at some of your stuff.
If you read her, you've read probably, if you read her regularly, I wrote 100-some articles for her back in the late 2010s.
I see those, yeah.
So. Sarah is such a lovely lady, by the way.
Oh, good.
We were just at, she spoke at a conference I put on in Florida, I guess in March. Yeah. So we just saw her in person in March.
Did you? So she's got a medical, like a more naturalistic medical kit that you can put together. And who else, like, I know you like Weston Price, Healthy Home Economist. Who else do you read when you're, you go to explore something?
Oh, goodness. Well, it depends on what I'm exploring. Okay. So you'd have to give me a subject. Okay. 'Cause Yeah, you'd have to give me a subject area.
So medical, if I'm putting, I'm trying to follow her and put together a medical kit that I would have with more naturalistic stuff. Who else would you follow?
Amy Fellwell, who is the founder of Homesteaders of America. She has a full like herbalist course on medical stuff. Who else would we use? We have Stephen Bruner's book on herbal antibiotics. Man, who else would we use medical-wise? See, huh? Yeah, we have a friend, Kim Licksteiner, who lives just over... Yeah, she's actually probably only 20 minutes from here. Really sweet Catholic lady. Her family's been part of our buying club, man, for like 12 or 13 years. And, you know, partly, too, it depends on which health issue we're talking about. You know, if we're talking about cancer, I'm probably going to read Thomas Cowan and a few other people like him. If we're talking about seasonal allergies, I'm going to read Chris Masterjohn and a few people along his vein. You know, Stephen Guyonnet, Rob Wolf. So medical is such, whereas if I'm talking about emergency medical, well, then that's where my prepper friends have been my influence. I had a really funny Facebook post years ago, right during the height of essential oilness. It's okay. How many of you are recovering essential oil addicts? Because I was on, you know, I was on Facebook back in the 2010s before it was nothing but ads and suggested posts and whatnot. And you'd see people, you know, somebody would be in a Facebook group and they'd be like, I just severed my left shoulder from my body. And there would be, you know, a young living lady who'd be like, have you tried lavender? I mean, there'd be people like really, really, you know, I have a heart rate of 207. Oh, peppermint essential oil is supposed to be so great for calming the nerves. I'm like, you are suffering a major medical issue. Why are you on Facebook? Who told you this was a good idea to seek medical help for major medical issues on social media? You know, so some of it depends on what severity we're working with here, you know. And then I drive all of my friends crazy. If you follow me on social media long enough, I will make you upset. I'm an equal opportunity offender because the last few years I've started playing around with peptides and other injectables. And a whole bunch of my, like, really hardcore, crunchy, natural friends have lost their minds. That, you know, I'm sitting here posting pictures of my kitchen table, basically looking, you know, I have vials of white powder. You're not hearing this, Mr. Policeman. I have all these vials of white powder and syringes and needles that I'm injecting into myself. And my friends are like, what have you done? And I'm like, I'm injecting peptides, which are actually fully natural compounds that your body produces. So, you know, so I'm very eclectic. There's a whole bunch of different people I'd pull from. If it was a specific issue and I wasn't sure who to start with, I have friends who I'd reach out to and say, hey, where would you start with this issue? You know, where would you start the rabbit hole down to finding options and solutions?
I see. Dr. Carl Page does a lot of peptides. Okay.
Yeah, peptides, I think, are going to... As long as the FDA doesn't, you know, it depends on who wins the next election and what happens with the FDA. I think they are one of the greatest advances in medicine basically ever. Over in Turkey, they surgically removed the meniscuses from a whole bunch of goats or lambs. I can't remember which animal. And then they made a gel using peptides and human growth hormone and a few other compounds, and they injected it into the knees of these animals, and the meniscus completely regrew. So, and one reason, so I the thing that got me into peptides, I train judo and jujitsu with my son Noah. So we lock ourselves in a padded room, we put on bathrobes, and then we fight large men until we're tired by slamming each other into things and trying to put each other to sleep at odd times of day. So that's one of my hobbies. And I somehow got a black belt in this hobby after 10 years of doing this to people. But last year, probably from a previous injury from soccer or ultimate frisbee, I had a tear in my meniscus. And I was getting ready for my black belt exams, and I'm walking around just all goofy because my knee's so messed up from this. And that's what got me into looking at peptides and stuff and playing with them. And I've just been blown away at... So I go to my doctor, I go to a physical therapist, and the doctor's like, you should just have knee meniscus surgery. Guess how much knee surgery a doctor gets paid on average for doing a knee meniscal, any kind of basic knee surgery? $10,000 is what they get. You know what the research shows for these surgeries? In less than 25% of people who get knee meniscus surgery, do they have a better outcome than people who just do physical therapy? But insurance, it's what they'll pay for, no questions asked. Oh, you have a torn meniscus? We'll automatically pay for surgery, even though the likelihood of it actually helping you is 1 in 4 and it costs $10,000. I spent, I don't know, $300-400 on peptides, and I'm back to fighting people half my age. So I love what's going on with peptides. Obviously, because there's not many doctors who will do them because the FDA, medical authorities do not like them. It's kind of a wild, wild west of self-experimentation. And if you're not that kind of person, it doesn't offend me at all. I am that kind of person. And I do know a few doctors who do that kind of stuff.
DMSO?
Yeah, it's a number of people highly recommend it for a number of different issues.
Yeah.
So all good other options. Yeah, and Sarah, I don't know if I'd always call her recommendations natural, in the sense of it's not like you can go pick DMSO off a tree. But they're definitely things that are much better options than what the mainstream medical often can give you. And it's well worth trying a lot of them because they're very low risk, possible high reward in situations where waiting doesn't make a difference. So other homesteady, productive household.
What does a day look like with young children in a homesteading, productive household with homeschooling?
Goodness. Well, you know, for us, it has varied a lot over 20 years. Because a lot has changed in our family over 20 years. And you know, one of the crazy things about having a larger family is every year in our family is almost a decade of life. You know, so we've gone through a couple generations of much smaller families. And a lot of people don't realize how much that changes really everything. A family with two kids... two adults and two kids is a completely different ball game than a family with 5, 6, 7, 8 kids. It's because again, there is so much more always going on. You know, so when we started this journey, we had no kids, and you know, another thing we did is just a lot of basic cooking. I had a lady who joined our buying club, and she came in, and she goes, "What's that?" I go, "What do you mean that?" I'm like, it's a chicken. It's a whole chicken. She's like, "That's what chickens..." This lady, in all of her years of cooking and being a wife, had never seen a whole uncooked chicken before. I could not believe it. So another thing is just getting back to actually cooking for your families. And cooking is not buying a box of pre-measured, pre-made ingredients and merely adding a couple items together, but like actually knowing how to cook things, actually knowing how to use all the parts of animals and other stuff. So when we first started adding kids, we still lived in Louisville, and it was a lot of cooking. It was a lot of us going on walks. Our Louisville life was pretty normal, I'd say. Once we moved out onto our homestead, it was, you know, then you have chores every day. And then you also have things like a productive household is a seasonal operation. It used to be the school schedule. You actually went to school in the middle of summer because it's too hot to really do anything. And you went to school in the middle of winter. And schools were off in the spring and in the fall because that is planting and calving and all of these seasons. And then the fall is harvest and butchering and stuff seasons. So our kind of annual schedule, you know, in the spring we're much busier because we have all the extra things of getting our high tunnel prepped, of getting the garden put in, of doing all these different things. And obviously then in the fall, we're just finishing up butchering all of our chickens for the year. We're just getting ready in the next few weeks to harvest out everything in the garden. Some years I'll do a fall garden. This year, for just all sorts of reasons, we didn't do a fall garden. You know, so part of it too is, you know, we have six kids, and my work varies. And I'm always looking for, as a man, what is the best use of my time? So time is your most valuable resource. And nothing, I'm speaking at both Homesteaders of America this year and at the Ozarks Homesteading Festival. I love the homesteading community, but there are a ton of knuckleheads in it. And so I once in a Facebook group asked how people were spending most of their time as a homesteader. And people, you know, I was like, what takes up most of your time? Because it drove some of the books I wrote. You know, because like getting back time, you get back an hour per day. That is 365 hours per year if you can get back an hour of your day somehow, which is why we just bought a robot vacuum for our house. And it's like one of the best things I ever did. It's just like literally I press a little remote button and it just goes around and it like cleans the entire floor of the house. It's amazing. It's heaven. And hopefully it's not talking to anyone in China. That's my only real concern with that guy. So I go on this Facebook group. I'm like, well, what are you spending time doing? And one guy's like, I spend about 10 hours a week watering stuff. Like, have you never heard of a soaker hose? Have you never heard of drip tape? I see homestead people waste huge amounts of time doing manual labor is neither inherently bad nor inherently good. There is no like extra reward in heaven because you individually cupped water onto each of your zucchini plants instead of running a thing of drip tape to do it for you. And some people in the homesteading community really think there is some kind of reward for whoever wastes the most time wins. So I'm a very, very ruthless homesteader in the sense of I only do things that add value. And value isn't just economic, but you can't overlook the economic part. So I don't grow potatoes anymore. I teach people how to grow potatoes, which is really ironic. I'm actually teaching people how to grow better potatoes at the Ozarks Homing thing. It's been a few years since I grew potatoes because I can buy really, really good organic potatoes for like $1.50 to $2 a pound. I cannot grow potatoes. Like the amount of time it takes me to grow potatoes does not justify me doing it as a dad with other obligations because I want to train judo and jiu-jitsu with my sons. I want to do other stuff like this. So our homesteading has changed some because when we first started homesteading, I was not quite as ruthless about doing things, and partly because I had to figure out what made the most sense. But I was not quite as ruthless about rooting out things that truly didn't add value to our family. So a typical day currently for us is we wake up, Jess and I wake up between 5:30 and 6:30. I some mornings will lift or bike. So we have a full set of weightlifting equipment right in our house because it's cheaper than, you know, even if I was in like 5 minutes from a gym, I might just get a gym membership. But then I'm also able to lift and exercise with my kids. So we work out usually first thing in the morning. I go do chores. This time of year, most days of the week, I can get all of my major homesteading chores in the morning done in 20 minutes. But that's partly because my kids each have chores. So, you know, all labor in an economy is given to mothers and fathers, and mothers and fathers squander the labor of their children. And this is a huge problem, especially in young stay-at-home moms who are constantly worn out, chasing after a bunch of small children, constantly cleaning up after them, because they don't involve them and actually make them work. And so our house has some really odd things about it. For instance, where do you keep your plates and bowls that need to go on the table? Where do most people keep them? They keep them up high where children can't get them. So since Abby, our plates and bowls are in the bottom cupboards of our house. Because from when she was like old enough to walk, three, four years old, she's the one who is responsible for setting the table. Because why? What are you going to have? So just think about how a lot of our households run. You have a mom who's trying to get food ready for dinner. The children are destroying one part of the house while she's both trying to cook and trying to set the table. Instead of a very small logistical change to your kitchen, now the children are profitably employed setting the table, which lightens mom's work, and they're not destroying another part of the house, or you're not having to put them in front of a TV or devices to get a few minutes of sanity. So then we have breakfast. We have breakfast 7 days a week. And my wife only cooks at 2 right now, maybe 3. And this, again, this all varies with our children. Because, again, like when Caleb was home, he had responsibilities at home. Since Caleb doesn't live at home anymore because he's working full-time for Shuck and Shelbyville, you know, all of this is just snapshots. And as a dad and as a mom, you want to learn to do what Paul says and administrate your household well. And so Abby cooks a few days a week. Our younger daughters do most of the cooking. Jess has to help with some of that because she's only 8 years old. And Ellie, our 11-year-old, is, you know, she would be considered disabled. So she's not quite as far along as, you know, Abby at 11 was cooking a full breakfast for the entire family. Are you thinking more like 9? and so again, you know, our children, they all have duties in cooking so that all the cooking doesn't fall on my wife. So some mornings Jess has to cook. Some mornings one of the other kids is doing cooking. Every day Jess has some sourdough stuff she does because we basically make all of our own bread, all of that kind of stuff, because it adds a bunch of value. You know, a few days a week, Abby has a muffin business. So she's making muffins to sell, you know, here up in Louisville. And then we get into homeschool. So we try and start homeschool, I think theoretically by 9 would be ideal. Life is not ideal when you have a big family. Things don't always run the way you wish they would. But usually no later than 9:30. Jess does homeschooling. I'm usually doing work of various kinds. I oversee a lot of Noah's homeschooling, so Noah comes and gets me throughout the morning to go over math with him or to go over other parts of his school with him or just to pick on him for why he's not getting these problems right when he should be. Would you consider this accurate?
Not my fault. You did. Highly advanced. I don't even know what math comes.
Yes.
You did that, so I know.
I also wrote a couple mathematics books when I was in college. So almost became a Unabomber. Just missed it. I will, in the mornings, if I go out to do certain kind of chores, I will pull some of the younger kids or my 4-year-old with me just to profitably employ him. I'll generally read some to our younger kids sometimes in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon, sometimes I'll take a little break. We usually take a walking break, especially when it's not basically like the 6th level of Dante's Inferno in Kentucky. Because lately it's been hard to want to go do anything outside. And so we'll take a walking break, and then we have lunch. And our goal usually is to try and be done with school by 2 to 2:30. You know, so ideally, we're done with school by 2 to 2:30 each day. And then in the afternoon, we read books, the kids play. I still sometimes have work calls or other things I need to do in the afternoon. We'll go again on another short family walk. And then in the evenings, I guess it's three nights a week, Monday, 3 to 4 nights a week, Noah and I train either judo or jiu-jitsu. So we usually eat an early dinner in our house because nothing will convince you to eat an earlier dinner like having a 250-pound policeman laying on top of you. And so you don't want to have any extraneous contents in your abdomen at that point. So we usually eat dinner between 4 and 5, and Noah and I are usually gone 5:30 to 8-ish. Yeah, it really varies a lot, the training schedule we have. Yeah, sometimes it's like 6:30 to 8:30 or 9. Sometimes it's 5:30 to 7:15. And then we get home, and people get exiled to the land of Nod, where Abraham dwelt. So, but then this base schedule gets life sprinkled over it. So the past few weeks, we've had chicken butchering. So one morning a week, I'm up at 5:30 making sure everything's ready for chicken butchering. And because we've trained our kids how to butcher animals since they were young, the one person who's not helping with butchering is responsible for breakfast and in the house. And then me and two of the kids are butchering off chickens. And so we have these kind of things. You know, so every week we have a family meeting where I basically talk the household through the schedule. This is our base schedule, and these are all of the things that also need to be pushed through this schedule this week, whether it's a judo tournament that Noah and I are competing at, or chicken butchering, or in a couple weeks it's going to be sweet potato harvest. All of these things have to be pushed through that base schedule. But our schedule, you know, but we only started doing judo and jiu-jitsu 9 years ago, so before that, we had a very different schedule. Because, again, all our kids were also younger. So as your kids get older, and again, this is something that's hard to understand until you have a lot of kids. You know, once you have 6 kids who all have things, all have their own lives as they get older, the family schedule can become quite frenetic unless you as a father really oversee that well. And, you know, for Jess, she makes soap usually once a month. You know, she has her own little world of things that she inserts into her schedule.
One final question. We'll go for dinner. All right. So you said you make your own toothpaste. I recently tried and failed to make my own toothpaste using eggshells. What's your secret?
You used eggshells?
Yeah.
Who told you this was a good idea?
I saw it on the internet, okay? They said it was good for your teeth.
Let me tell you. this is going to be very surprising. As Abraham Lincoln said, you can't trust everything you see on the internet. We don't currently make our own toothpaste. I do actually want to get back into doing it because I'm pretty sure they're going to discover. They discovered this about tea bags recently, that tea, whenever you make tea, you are drinking like a million microplastic particles in every cup of tea you drink. It just drives me nuts that we have made a world that is completely toxic to ourselves for no benefit, you know, to save 7 cents here and 4 cents there. But there's some really good basic the Healthy Home Economist. I might have written the toothpaste recipe that's on her website. You know, but there's just a couple basic ingredients, and none of them are eggshells. You would have saved yourself a very disgusting experience.